worth reiterating that this really is the fastest exodus of people on this scale, certainly in Europe, since the Second World War.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which began on the 24th of February, has resulted in the displacement of millions of Ukrainians. The responses taken by governments around the world, such as the activation of the Temporary Protection Directive by the EU, and the challenges being faced, have prompted questions around how best to assist displaced people, while the situation has also highlighted the continuing plight of refugees from Afghanistan and other crisis zones. Matt Saltmarsh, head of news and media for the UN's refugee agency, UNHCR, assesses the situation in Ukraine and the international response to the displacement crisis.
So far, we're almost 2 months into this crisis. There are 4.6 million refugees who have fled Ukraine, and the majority of them are in the neighboring countries, with the largest number being in Poland, of course. There was a large movement initially of people to the borders and across the borders, and that picked up in the first couple of weeks. Poland was seeing at one point over 140,000 arrivals a day. As the crisis has worn on, the numbers have diminished, and that could be because the epicenter of the fighting has moved. One thing we did notice is that as the weeks wore on, those who were arriving and crossing the borders were in a more traumatized state, more vulnerable people. Obviously, we know that the vast majority, around 90%, are women and children anyway, so they already have some specific needs. But those who were coming slightly later perhaps had experienced conflict firsthand themselves. So that means that the needs, even though the numbers have been going down, the needs haven't been going down. I mean, my experience was from Poland, and there people would typically cross the border relatively quickly, but then they would typically be quickly taken by the authorities to reception centers in Poland, quite close to the border, again for a short stay so that they can sort of gather themselves and rest up for a bit. And then the Poles were trying to find solutions in terms of taking them onwards. And of course, some people have moved on to Western Europe as well. And once they've crossed into Poland, they're in the Schengen zone. So there is that ability to move freely across the European Union, or at least the Schengen area. They've initiated what's known as the Temporary Protection Directive. This was originally formulated back during the time of the Balkan Wars to envisage a potential large influx of people. It was never formally activated until now. It takes away all of that complication around the need for asylum claims and status and biometrics initially as well. It's worth reiterating that this really is the fastest exodus of people on this scale, certainly in Europe, since the Second World War. So this Temporary Protection Directive has been hugely helpful and beneficial. You can imagine how difficult it would be to process individual asylum claims in different countries for this scale of people. We've had generous offers from countries like the UK, from Canada, and from the US to receive Ukrainian refugees, which is hugely welcome. But it does present another level of complexity, because what we've seen, certainly in the UK case, that the Home Office has certainly struggled to meet the demand of people who want to host Ukrainian refugees, because there is a certain level of formality and paperwork that needs to be done. And you could well see the same in countries like Canada and the US, where more bespoke programs are set up. The reaction to the Ukraine crisis has been hugely positive, both in terms of the coverage, the outpouring of support from individuals, from the public, and also from governments and the private sector in terms of fundraising, which has been phenomenal, almost probably unprecedented, I would say. But on the flip side, it's very important, I think, to stress that, you know, there are at least 85 million forcibly displaced people in the world. And the needs for those people haven't gone away at all. And indeed, if you look at the economic backdrop, in many ways, it's much, much more difficult now because of economic contractions and inflation. So while the Ukraine situation and the appeals for Ukraine have been generously funded so far, which is very positive. When we look across the world at some other situations, they're still chronically underfunded. And our Central African Republic fund for this year is only 6% funded. Iraq is 8% funded. I mean, that's important, but it's not just about funding. I think it's also about the sense of fairness in terms of the asylum system. And we've been saying for a long time, we always say that asylum is not negotiable. The right to asylum is universal. And in the lead up, particularly to the Ukraine crisis, we saw a number of incidents, many in Europe, but not just in Europe, across the world, where asylum seekers were pushed back, were not given access to asylum. In many cases, there were measures that were imposed for COVID that still haven't been lifted, but to, let's not forget, those other parts of the world, particularly in lesser developed countries where still the majority of refugees are hosted.
Greg Siskind, Vice Chair of the IBA Immigration and Nationality Law Committee and a founding partner at Siskind Susser in Memphis, describes the need for a coordinated, compassionate response from the international community and the harsh light that the Ukraine crisis has thrown on the handling of the situation in Afghanistan.
Some countries have, I think, done an extraordinary job. Poland and Canada, I would rank as sort of the best. Well, Poland have decided that we're going to let everybody in, and then we'll deal with the bureaucratic part of it afterwards. It's an emergency. Let's just get people here and ensure that their basic needs are being taken care of, food and shelter. In a refugee crisis, the last thing you want is to set up a whole bureaucratic structure that has to, where people have to jump through hoops before they can, you know, escape to safety. They're not putting any kind of stress on this population as far as giving them an indication that they expect them to, you know, exit for other countries or go back to Ukraine at any point. And all the rhetoric from their leadership seems to be welcoming. And other countries, I think, have literally done the least that they could get away with, which I would put the U.S. in that category. You know, even though the administration says they're going to take 100,000, I mean, the fact of the matter is we could take a whole lot more. I mean, they're kind of in a difficult spot because they have a very recent precedent. There were about 80,000 Afghans that were evacuated quickly. There's about 40,000 Afghans that are waiting on something called humanitarian parole outside the country. Some of them are still in Afghanistan. Some of them are in Pakistan and surrounding countries. And those applications have been sitting there unadjudicated, 40,000 of them, for about 7 months now, or 8 months, or since August. And you know, all of a sudden, that's coming to light, the fact that all those people are still waiting. And there's another population now that, you know, a lot of people are rightly sympathetic that population also needs to be taken care of. But the administration's, you know, has done such a poor job with the previous group. And there are only 27 countries that have full-on refugee resettlement programs. And the U.S. is one, and we've over the years tried to encourage other countries to join. But we're supposed to be leading in that space. And I think most people in the refugee advocacy community in the U.S. feel like we're no longer playing that role. And there's some of the countries that have been traditionally the leaders in refugee resettlement need to step up and actually be vocal in terms of laying out the case for coordinated response and getting, you know, to dealing with really numbers that we haven't seen in generations.
Alex Stoichevich, Refugee Officer of the IBA Immigration and Nationality Law Committee and founding and managing partner of MKS Lawyers in Vancouver, discusses the IBA's proposal for emergency evacuation visas to coordinate an international response to situations such as those in Ukraine and Afghanistan.
Emergency evacuation visas are a concept that the IBA has developed and supported and our committee has endorsed. The idea behind this is to deal with a number of different problems and bottleneck issues whereby the world's, you know, displaced persons increasingly are stuck in particularly difficult positions in developing nations where the global north is spending more and more money trying to house them there, where they're in precarious situations rather than moving them onward. And the idea behind them is in emergency situations, not urgent ones, but emergency ones where people are at direct risk of life in particular, you bring a multilateral, multi-organizational approach to trying to first get people out of a dangerous situation into a safer one, and then triage them with the entire range of multilateral, multinational, complementary pathways to both refugee protection and immigration, and try to match them as best you can. So a model for this is what was done in Libya by the Italians in 2017 during the civil war. The Italians identified 1,000 people, or between 800 and 1,000 people, that they wanted to move quickly out of Libya. They moved them out to Sicily first. They created a triage center. They got agreement from numerous NGOs that deal with refugee resettlement, et cetera, to set up like a triage arrangement, in that when the potential migrants arrived, the people that were given these visas and were brought in, they were then dealt with immediately by NGOs. They had exposure to legal advice. Every type of Italian pathway to permanent residence was explored: refugee protection for some, family reunification for others, and all was done in a complementary sort of way. Whereas, and with the maximum amount of agency for the migrants themselves, so people could choose which way they wanted to go, so that if people didn't want to forestall a potential for returning one day to the country that was affected, perhaps when the Libyan civil war was over, they could choose a family reunification option over a protection option, to give you an example. This worked very well. They processed a lot of people in a very short period of time. A lot of community groups got involved at the grassroots. And this has largely informed some of the elements in the emergency evacuation visa model. So in the Ukrainian example, you actually have a lot of these principles being done. They're just being done in an ad hoc way, and they're not being done multilaterally. So for example, in Poland, nobody is seriously going through and considering if these people need protection or not. They're simply giving them identity numbers and letting them work and giving them access to healthcare and sorting out afterwards how they will fit the long-term immigration system in Europe. How Canada has reacted is very much an emergency evacuation visa approach, with the emergency evacuation being outsourced to somebody else, in the sense that, the people have left already, they're in a place of safety. What Canada has done is essentially said, anyone who wants a visa to come to Canada who's Ukrainian has to apply for one, and we'll give it to them. And thus far, in practice, people are getting them in less than 2 weeks. And once they are here, they're being given a work permit that is valid for up to 3 years, depending on how long their passport is valid. And it's open, and there's no strings attached to it. This is the first time we have done this in a very long time. Some of the barriers that we have, unfortunately, though, are significant, and that is international treaties. Biometrics as a concept is a critical part of the Five Eyes Agreement, which the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States have all signed onto. Because right now, it isn't visa issuance that's the problem. The problem is, or even passport, because they're recognizing that they'll let people in with an identity card. It's the biometrics that are causing the backlog, because you can't get through to these visa application centers. So one pilot that's being floated from a number of countries is to have a mobile biometric station. And hopefully that will do something to reduce the barrier. In the EEV proposal that we've put forward, the idea would be that you would have a permanent committee who would advise the UNHCR on triggering mechanisms for when EEVs could be used. Afghanistan was the perfect situation. If we had had something in place where resources could be pooled, on the understanding that everybody would participate that could in terms of moving people, and accepting people and in the full complement again of processes, then, you know, you would have had a more coherent international response. I think we need to use this Ukrainian example now as a template and forget about, you know, the previous approaches. I think increasingly we should be looking to this way to do it. You know, get people to safety, then worry about the other elements. I think this is the tip of the iceberg. We thought the civil war in Syria and the chronic a generational problem in Afghanistan, because we've had migrants from Afghanistan moving out into the rest of the world for a generation. That is potentially peanuts compared to what climate change could rot. What happens when an island disappears and we have to evacuate 50,000 people overnight?